morning and welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. We are a welcoming congregation, so whatever your race, spiritual perspective, ethnicity, physical ability, or sexual orientation, we celebrate your presence among us. My name is Jim Hansen. I'll be your board rep today. And we have a variety of announcements on church life and activities that are in your order of service, and we encourage you to take that home with you so you have it. A couple other announcements. The monthly food pantry collection today will be for the Sussex Food Pantry, and monetary donations, you can make your check out to LCUUC and put a note on the memo line, and loose cash will also go to the Sussex Food Pantry. And another announcement is the suet fruit and nut sale items are in. Please pick up your order from the table in the foyer, and profits from this, I don't know if you've heard them recently, I always enjoy hearing the ads for the Unitarian Church on our local public radio stations. And I invite you to greet those sitting around you. Hey, good morning. Good to see you.
So how long have you been on board?
I guess this is my second year.
Finding an
interest. It's my second year. I don't know if I mentioned that. Okay, I think we're done with that. If you're visiting us today, we particularly welcome you and encourage you to sign the guest ledger that on the visitor's table in the foyer. There's a variety of information out there on Unitarian Universalism, so feel free to help yourself to anything that interests you. I'll be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions, and if I can't answer them, I'll point you to someone who can. If you're visiting with your children, it's our custom that the children remain with us until after the story for all ages, at which time they go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join or remain in the service. If you would like to go with your child to observe the class, please do so. The nursery is just out the door to my right and across the entryway. Classes end at 11:15, at which time you can pick up your kids. We always enjoy getting to know our guests, so if any members have brought guests today, we would be pleased if you would introduce them, or if you have brought yourself and would like to and feel comfortable, introduce yourself. Now would be a good time. Welcome. Welcome. Okay, everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. Conversation Corner is a good way to continue the service from in here. Please put your cell phones on silence mode if you haven't already. And I hope you find today's service stimulating. I hope it will touch your heart and stir your spirit. Today's speaker is the Reverend Drew Kennedy, who is the minister at the First Unitarian Society on the east side of Milwaukee. He was born and raised in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. He had his BA in philosophy from the University of Michigan, his master's and doctorate of ministry degrees from Meadville Lombard Theological. He's active in various denominational and community affairs, serving on various boards and committee and advocating such things as LGBT rights, women's reproductive freedom, assisted suicide, separation of church and state, nuclear disarmament, and economic justice. He's married to Lois Wessner, who is here today and has two grown children. And for fun, he's an avid year-round soccer player. So at this time, I will turn it over to Reverend Andrew Kennedy.
Chalice lighting words are adapted from the Reverend Lindsay Bates. To face the world of shadows, a chalice of light. To face the world of coldness, a chalice of warmth. To face the world's future, a chalice of memories. To face the world's questions, a chalice of stories. To face the world's terrors, a chalice of courage. To face the world's turmoil, a chalice of peace. May its glow fill our spirits, our hearts, and our lives. Please stand as you are willing and able to join in the singing of hymn 322. We'll sing the first three stanzas.
hello.
So children, anybody who'd like to come forward for the story for all ages, which actually, I'm really happy you all came forward, but today it's actually a quiz. Okay. First of all, I'm going to teach you a new word today. Hopefully it's a new word. Some of you may know this. I'm going to teach you the word semiotics. Okay? So, you're kind of going, I don't think I've learned that one yet. What do you think this word means? Anybody, you know, anybody been studying their Greek and Latin roots and just kind of want to snap out? Okay. It means the study of signs or symbols. Okay? So, what is a sign or a symbol? Who can give me a definition of what those words might mean? Go ahead. Okay, yin-yang is a sign or a symbol. Very good. Okay, I'll give you a simple example. Well, I'll give you a definition, and you'll probably kind of go, huh, to the definition. Definition is a sign or a symbol, is something that points to something else. So, let's start with a really simple example. What's this?
Shell.
A shell, right. You look at it, hey, that's a shell. So, what does a shell mean?
It's a shell.
It is what it is, right? Okay. What's this? Just shell. And what does it mean? Strangely, it means stop here, get gas. Okay, so you guys actually know stuff about signs already without actually knowing words like semiotics and whatnot. So we're actually going to learn a little bit about signs and quiz you as we go of what you know about signs. And these will actually be fairly simple, you'll find, because we are so used to having signs around us all the time. So, let's see here. I'm going to start with this one. What is this? It doesn't say stop, yet you still sort of recognize it as a stop sign. So a literalist would say, well, that's a red hexagon on a piece of paper. Because they don't recognize it as a sign. So if you come from some place where nobody uses this sign, they're like, hey, he's holding up a red hexagon. Octagon, sorry. Thank you. Eight sides. Yeah, I do. I do need to do that. So what is that sign for? What does that sign mean? Go ahead. Stop and wait for cars to pass by. Is that all it means? No? What else does it mean?
Stop.
Stop?
Or stop what you're doing.
Okay, people can use it to say stop what you're doing. Now, how many of you drive?
Oh.
Okay. Of those of you who don't drive, why do you know what that sign means? If that's for car drivers to stop their cars usually, why do you know what that means? Your mom told you, because you ride with other people who drive. Now, there's something else that sign means as well. So when you were growing up and your parents were teaching you to cross the street, where did they tell you to cross the street at? At corners, at stop signs. So the stop sign can mean to people who don't drive, this is a safe place to cross the street. So signs can have multiple meanings for different types of people. So now, here's a quick list of some other signs you may see when you're visiting your local park. So does anybody know what number 7 is there, if they've got good enough sight to see it? Danger, rocks falling down the hill. Yeah, very good. Okay, how about number 23?
Recycling bin.
The recycling bin. Yeah, the recycling sign. So we just learned to know those signs from seeing them all the time. Okay, we'll go through a quick couple other ones. What's this stand for?
Double.
What's this one?
Happy.
How many of you drink coffee every day? Why do you think you know what this sign means if you're not a coffee drinker?
Because they don't just sell coffee.
They got hot chocolate. They've got other things. Yes, what? Yeah, so it's everywhere. Okay, how about this one?
Nike.
Okay, you guys are good at this. See, I told you this was a really easy quiz. So here's a really simple one. Okay. There's a lot of stuff going on in this one. There's all sorts of stuff. Okay, hold on a second. Okay. So what's different about this one? So those other ones we showed you were what? What are they also known as opposed to signs? The brand names? What?
Advertisements.
Advertisements, they're logos. It's a way of business wants you to recognize them wherever they are. So if you're in Singapore and you say, boy, I'd really love some coffee just like I had in Heartland, you might look for the Starbucks sign. Now, this is very different. What's this a sign for? Do any of you know? Go ahead.
A country.
Very good. What's it called? It's got a different name.
Coat of arms.
Yes. This one is for Cardiff, Wales. And Cardiff built a lot of different things into there. They got a dragon. They've got a seahorse. They've got a goat. They've got stuff in Welsh on there and so on because they wanted to show a lot of different things with their symbol. Okay, here's some other ones you guys probably recognize.
Those are all the
superheroes.
Spider-Man, Batman, Superman, X-Men, Flash, Fantastic Four, Punisher, Captain America, The Avengers, Incredibles, and Wonder Woman.
Very good. So somebody's been working hard. You guys are going to pass this course. You should. Okay, these symbols.
Oh, those are...
Very good. We don't use these as much anymore. People have simplified them, and there's a bunch of different ways to show these, but these used to be very popular. So if we were testing you in probably 1400s, you'd go, oh, yeah, that's Aries and that's Sagittarius. But so there's lots of symbols all around us. So here we are in this building. Are there any symbols in this building?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead. What seems to be the most important symbol on that banner if you were, say, based on size? Go ahead.
The chalice.
Does everybody look at that and say, you know, a chalice is what? What do you do with a chalice? What is it?
Go ahead. You light it on fire.
Do you normally light it on fire? If somebody were offering you a drink from a cup, would you expect it to be on fire normally? Well, as you can see, the chalice, the flaming chalice, is a symbol that Unitarians use. It's one that we show a lot. We not only have the symbol of the flaming chalice, right above it, we have an actual flaming chalice. And what we're going to do is we're going to learn about where that symbol came from today. So unfortunately, you guys are going to be leaving here shortly, and you're going to miss all this discussion. And so what I want you to do is after we're done with the service today, ask your parents, where does the flaming chalice come from? Why is it the symbol that Unitarians use? So you can learn a little bit more about it and understand what it represents and how it represents you. Now then, I have one of you has been chosen. Lantern now. Selected. And notice what we're going to do. This is what's called a symbolic action, in that we are going to take the flame from the original lantern. We got that? Fire.
Always a good idea.
So we're taking the flame from
later after all the kids leave. Now's the time in our service for our joys and concerns. This is a time when we can share any of our great joys or our profound sorrows with the congregation. If you choose to share, please raise your hand and an usher will bring around a microphone. I will start by lighting a candle to our memorial candle here to represent all the many conflicts that are happening in this world and our hope that there will be a peaceful resolution to them. And now I invite you to share your joys and concerns.
Good morning, I'm Barbara, and I'd like you to light a candle of concern for my neighbor and friend, Janet, who has just been diagnosed with stage 4 kidney cancer.
Hi, I'm Sue, and could you light a candle of joy? Fjorn turned 12 yesterday, which completed our annual 15-day family birthday blitz.
I'm Susan, and I have both a joy and a concern. My joy is finding the love of my life, Ryan. And the sorrow that I have is that I'm out of work yet again. And my regret is that I have to spend so much of my time taking care of myself when I would rather be serving others.
Paul, this is Carlin. Would you please light a candle of concern for my father, who has had two strokes in the last week and prostate difficulties and surgery, so he's not in good shape.
I'm Terry, and I'd like to light a candle of joy for my father, who just turned 88 on Monday, or I can't remember which day, but this week, and also for our granddaughter, who just became 6 months old this week, so full circle.
My name is Esther. Please light a candle of joy. Last night, Terry Copeland held a... please light a candle of joy. We had a party last night at Terry Copeland's place, and her husband, John, prepared this wonderful pasta party, or pasta meal from or the tomatoes grown in their garden, and this was part of our silent auction. And there were 40 of us there, so it was fun.
This is Phil. A candle of joy for Lynn and I. It's our this past week was our 27th wedding anniversary.
This is Al. A candle of shared joy for our community. 14 years ago, after the kids left, and the adults with the kids to teach them already left, there was probably about 15 people. So a joy for our abundance.
I'm going to read you because I like reading poetry. by Billy Collins, who's one of my favorite poets. And in this poem, Billy Collins humorously faces the issue of the overuse of symbolism, particularly that that can be said of poet in a poem. But I think he also opens the door to the question, if you were to create a symbol for yourself, what would it be? So after I finish reading the poem, I'm going to give a moment of silence for you to just focus yourself and think about that. So here's the poem. It's called Litany by Billy Collins. And he starts with a quote from another poet. The quote is, "You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine," by Jax Crickillon. "You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine. You are the dew on the morning grass and the burning wheel of the sun. You are the white apron of the baker and the marsh birds suddenly in flight. However, you are not the wind in the orchard, the plums on the counter, or the house of cards, and you are certainly not the pine-scented air. There is just no way you are the pine-scented air. It is impossible, it is possible, that you are the fish under the bridge, maybe even the pigeon on the general's head, but you're not even close to the field of cornflowers at dusk. And a quick look in the mirror will show that you are neither the boots in the corner nor the boat asleep in the boathouse. It might interest you to know, speaking of the plentiful imagery of the world, that I am the sound of rain on the roof. I also happen to be the shooting star, the evening paper blowing down an alley, and the basket of chestnuts on the kitchen table. I am also the moon in the trees and the blind woman's teacup. But don't worry, I am not the bread and the knife. You are still the bread and the knife. You will always be the bread and the knife, not to mention the crystal goblet and somehow the wine."
Morning. It's great to be here again. My name is Drew Kennedy, and the last time I was here was in September of 2006, 5 years ago. For the occasion then was the dedication of this building. It's great to be back among you. Today I want to share the fascinating and layered story of the flaming chalice. So our reading for this morning is taken from a little pamphlet that was published by the Unitarian Universalist Association entitled The Flaming Chalice. It was written by the Reverend Dan Hotchkiss. At the opening of Unitarian Universalist worship services, Hotchkiss begins, many congregations light a flame inside a chalice, as you do, This flaming chalice has become the well-known symbol of our denomination. It unites our members in worship and symbolizes the spirit of our work. The flaming chalice combines two archetypes, a drinking vessel and a flame. As a religious symbol, it has different meanings for different beholders. The chalice and the flame were brought together as a Unitarian symbol by the Austrian artist Hans Deutsch in 1941. Living in Paris during the 1930s, Deutsch drew critical cartoons of Adolf Hitler. When the Nazis invaded Paris in 1940, he abandoned all that he had and fled to the south of France, then to Spain, and finally, with an altered passport, into Portugal. There, Deutsch met the Reverend Charles Joy, executive director of the Unitarian Service Committee, USC. The service committee was new, founded in Boston when Czech Unitarians asked for help. The Czech Unitarians were persecuted by the Nazis because they stood for freedom and opposed racism, and because their leaders were courageous and outspoken. Although the Unitarian Service Committee was founded to save Czech Unitarians, it quickly became involved in the much larger effort to save Jews. From his Lisbon headquarters, Joy oversaw a secret network of couriers and agents. Deutsch was most impressed and was soon working for the USC, the Unitarian Service Committee. The USC was an unknown organization in 1941. This was a disadvantage in wartime when establishing trust quickly across barriers of language, nationality, and faith could mean life instead of death. Disguises, signs and countersigns, and midnight runs across guarded borders were the means of freedom in those days. Joy asked Deutsch to create a symbol for the USC's papers. As Joy said, quote, to make them look official, to give dignity and importance to them, and at the same time to symbolize the spirit of our work. End quote. Thus, Hans Deutsch made his lasting contribution to the USC and, as it turned out, to Unitarian Universalism. With pencil and ink, he drew a chalice with a flame. The flaming chalice design was made into a seal for papers and a badge for agents moving refugees to freedom. In time, it became a symbol of Unitarian Universalism all around the world. The story of Hans Deutsch reminds us that the symbol of the flaming chalice stood in the beginning for a life of service. When Deutsch designed the flaming chalice, he had never seen a Unitarian or Universalist church or heard a sermon. What he had seen was faith in action, people who were willing to risk all for others in a time of urgent need. This concludes our reading for this morning. At this time, I would invite you to stand as you're able and join in singing number 86.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Please be seated. In his book, Lake Wobegon Days, Garrison Keillor describes his own religious background in terms with which many present-day Unitarian Universalists, including many of you perhaps, can readily identify. Keillor said, "In a town where everyone was either Lutheran or Catholic, we were neither one. We were sanctified brethren, a sect so tiny that nobody but us and God even knew about it. So when kids asked what I was, I just said Protestant." It was, Keillor continues, too much to explain. Like having six toes. You would rather just keep your shoes on. Well, it strikes me that that's it exactly for us sometimes as well. Rather than having to try to explain Unitarian Universalism and what it is, we would sometimes at least rather just keep our shoes on and hold our tongue. Now, while I cannot promise today to get you entirely off the conversational hook about what Unitarian Universalism means, nevertheless, knowing the story of the flaming chalice may, in fact, be an important touchstone to understanding, appreciating, and articulating something, at least, of the heart and soul of Unitarian Universalism. Now, just a minute ago in our reading, we heard the more immediate story behind the Flaming Chalice, which revolved around Hans Deutsch. Deutsch, again, was the Austrian refugee who designed the Flaming Chalice as a logo for the Unitarian Service Committee during World War II. But in designing the flaming chalice as a symbol of freedom for those fleeing the Nazis, Deutsch, whether consciously or unconsciously, was drawing upon a potent, already existing symbol of freedom in Eastern Europe, which dates back at least to the 1400s. Indeed, in the 1400s, the flaming chalice was actually rather widely worn on people's coats and even on battle armor. The potency of this symbol is testified to by the following story by a colleague of mine named Jane Zepka, who writes, "My friend and colleague Mark Bellatini tells about one of his parishioners who grew up in Slovakia and was a child when the Nazis arrived. It is a horrible story, where the little girl watched as her parents were shot, watched as later numbers were tattooed on her arm in the camps, watched as friends disappeared. And yet, she survived. I'd probably say that luck helped her to survive and sublime survivor skills, but the thing that she claimed got her through day after day was this small daily act. She took her finger and each day in the talcum-like dirt of the concentration camp, she sketched a chalice. Her symbol of freedom. Under the chalice, she wrote the Czech words for truth overcomes. She said, quote, "My sketch of the chalice on the ground contained the sacred wine of hope, which I drank every day to my delight. That sketch in the dirt gave meaning to my terrible life. Excuse me, end quote. So clearly, there was considerable power in that symbol which Deutsch was pulling on in designing the flaming chalice. That power derives from a much earlier, much richer story of the flaming chalice. Indeed, once you know this older backstory, if you're like me, you may never forget it, or at least the rough outlines of it. And it just may help you, in some small way, to explain Unitarian Universalism when you're ready to take your shoes off. It all goes back to a man named Jan Hus, or anglicized, it would be John Huss. Huss was born in 1369 in southern Bohemia, which is now the Czech Republic and was once Czechoslovakia. John Huss lived toward the end of the European medieval times, at the beginning of the Renaissance period, and a whole century or so before people like Michael Servetus, Martin Luther, John Calvin, and others of the Protestant Reformation, who broke away from the Roman Catholic Church. Huss, along with a few others, paved the way for that later Protestant Reformation. Huss, like the Unitarian Michael Servetus after him, may not seem very radical by our standards today, but for his views, he faced almost alone incredible resistance from a vast power structure for things which we today would largely take for granted. The Roman Catholic Church at the time was firmly committed to an elaborate ecclesiastical system, assumed and sincerely believed by many to be divinely ordained, to be supremely important, and to be worth defending literally to the death. Of Huss's early life, we know next to nothing. We do know that he eventually graduated from the University of Prague with degrees in philosophy, art, and theology between 1393 and 1404. Huss was ordained to the priesthood in 1401, and that same year was elected dean of the arts faculty of the University of Prague. He became popular partly for his teaching and partly for his preaching in the vernacular instead of in Latin, as was the church's custom in that day for the most part. There were exceptions, but for the most part, Mass was said in Latin. The next year, in 1402, Huss was named stated preacher of the Bethlehem Chapel, which the church had set up some years earlier as a place specifically for preaching in the Czech language. Again, one of the few places. Huss was enormously successful in filling the church with Czechs of all classes, so that on most Sundays it was reported that even the rafters were well inhabited. Again, part of Huss's popularity as a preacher was due to his preaching in the everyday language, but part of it was also apparently due to the fact that Huss truly spoke to people's real life concerns, to the age in which they lived, and to what made their heads ache and their hearts throb. Despite Huss's enormous popularity among the Czech people, and perhaps partly because of it, Huss began running into trouble. Huss was a disciple, philosophically and theologically, of an English church reformer named John Wycliffe, whose controversial teachings Huss had embraced when in school. Wycliffe and Huss both believed in predestination, as the Roman Catholic Church did too. But Wycliffe and Huss went on to argue that since only God knows who is predestined for glory and who is predestined for hell, then the Pope and his entire ecclesiastical hierarchy are clearly unnecessary. They serve no vital function in God's scheme of salvation, they argued. Rather, for Wycliffe and Huss, Christ, Jesus Christ, ought to be the head of the church, not the Pope. And you can guess who's going to be unhappy with that sentiment. Well, Huss also believed, contrary to church doctrine, that both the bread and the wine of Holy Communion should be given to the congregation at Mass. The church's long-standing tradition, which was not changed till much later, until Vatican II in the 1960s, was that only the bread was to be shared with the congregation, while the consecrated wine was reserved only for the priests. Well, Huss wanted to change all of that. Objections to Huss's idea of distributing the wine to the laity were best articulated by an irate churchman by the name of Garrison, who cited four major objections to sharing the wine with the congregation. First, Garrison argued, some of the precious, blood of Christ might be spilled by clumsy lay people. Second, the wine might become contaminated by the beards of laymen. Now, the priests' beards are not a problem, Garrison explained, because the priests themselves, including their beards, have been consecrated, so there wouldn't be any contamination from them. Third, and here's a consideration, if shared with the congregation, the wine might freeze as it was passed around in the church on a cold day. And that was because these cathedrals, you know, they were huge and they were largely unheated, especially at the far end from what they call, from the holy end. The holy end had some heat, but not the back. So the wine might freeze back there. So Garrison argued. Fourth, and finally, sharing the wine with the congregation might suggest that priests and lay people are equal. And here is clearly the rub. For this last point was exactly what John Huss intended to suggest. That priests and lay people are equal before God. Now, as I've already hinted, Huss's ideas about the Pope's dispensability and about changing the practices of Holy Communion did little to endear him to the Pope and his bishops. Well, I should say, it did little to endear him to the popes in the plural, because at that time, and indeed throughout Huss's entire life, there were actually three popes at the same time. Three popes. It's a long and complicated story, which we can't go into today, but you go home and Google it. Three popes and 1400s thereabout, and you'll find it. In any case, Huss attacked, the whole idea of having a pope, even one pope, and this, of course, was exacerbated by the fact that there were three popes. Huss's attack on the popes was popular among many of the Czech people who were being taxed for all of this, after all. But guess what? It was not so popular with any of the popes. Meanwhile, Huss was getting into trouble at the university as well. John Wycliffe's teachings, which Huss endorsed, came under stiff attack from a party of largely German professors at the university who were demanding strict condemnation of Wycliffe's views. Huss and a few friends stepped in to defend Wycliffe from charges of heresy, which eventually led to a struggle for control of the university. When the struggle was over, our man John Huss and the Czechs had won. Indeed, Huss was appointed rector of the university, and the German professors packed up and left to form their own university. Opposition to Huss on the part of the conservative Czech clergy in Prague, however, remained. Indeed, a papal bull issued in 1410 ordered the burning of Wycliffe's books. Huss again rose to Wycliffe's defense, preaching against the decree and thereby further antagonizing the church. Huss was summoned to Rome to account for himself, but refused to go, and was finally excommunicated by the church in 1411. Among the Czech people, Huss's excommunication was not a popular decision. Not at all. The archbishop himself came to Huss's church on a Sunday morning at Bethlehem Chapel to announce the Pope's decree of excommunication. As the archbishop began reading this decree, this announcement of his excommunication, the congregation simply picked up the archbishop, robes, mitre and all, and carried him straight out of the church. It's one way of handling conflict resolution, I suppose. So Huss, feeling the support, boldly continued in his preaching. The church authorities then brought ominous threats and stronger measures to bear on Huss until he was finally forced into exile the next year. That was in 1412. Huss continued to write and to agitate for church reform while in exile. And even while in exile, his enemies were still angry and threatened. And so they searched his books for heresies. They banned his hymns. They even followed him and eavesdropped on him, gathering evidence. Finally, in 1414, Huss's enemies made their final move. Huss, still in exile, was invited to participate in something called the Council of Constance, which was a location, a deliberative body, this council was, which was organized to try to resolve some of the conflicts that were then raging within the Roman Catholic Church. Huss was offered a safe conduct pass from the emperor, and so he went. Huss arrived, expecting to be able to promote his controversial teachings, but instead was soon arrested, taken to a dungeon, and chained hands and feet to the wall. So much for the safe conduct pass. Then he was tried in a special court. At his trial, he faced the well-seasoned, by now, wrath of some of the very professors who had lost out to Huss in the power struggle at the University of Prague years before. While some 250 nobles signed a petition pleading for Huss's release, and while even the court had to admit that communion wine had in fact been given to all men and women in the early Christian churches, still John Huss was condemned by the court and he refused to recant. At the close of Huss's trial on July 6, 1415, Huss was forced to wear his priestly garments and was handed a communion chalice of wine. The charges were read. Huss was pronounced guilty. Then his priestly robes were dramatically torn from his body while one of his accusers rudely grabbed the communion chalice from his hands, shouting, "We take from thee the cup of redemption." And this, friends, is the older story, the more distant source of the chalice, the cup of our flaming chalice, the symbol of Unitarian Universalism. This is the chalice which John Huss, clearly at his peril, shared equally among the clergy and lay people. And significantly, you'll note that in most Unitarian Universalist churches that I'm acquainted with, the custom is that the lay people light the chalice, not the ministers, as in fact you do and as we do downtown. In any case, stripped of his priestly robes and the Holy Communion chalice, Huss was then taken out and burned to death at the stake. And thus the flame is joined to the top of the chalice to complete our flaming chalice symbol, symbolizing both the beauty and the cost of those who would stand up and speak out, not only for equality before God, but for spiritual freedom, for the right to think for ourselves, and for the right to speak truth to power. This, then, is the backstory to the flaming chalice. At this time, let me invite just a few moments of silence for reflection before we begin our polylogue.
Time for a polylogue, which is a time in our service where anybody in the congregation can share their insights and reflections on what we've just heard. Please offer your comments, remembering the many perspectives we represent, and the speaker's available after the service. Drew is available after the service at the social hour to ask questions as well, less publicly. So if you raise your hand, an usher will bring a microphone to you, and please tell us your name and briefly share your thoughts.
Hi, I'm John, and I thank you for sharing that fascinating story. One of the things that's always struck me a little bit about the symbol of the flaming chalice is it has just a little bit of representation of our Christian heritage in that it always looks to me just a little bit like a modified cross a little bit. And that's just something that struck me a little bit, and I thought maybe that might enter the story somewhere, but apparently it hasn't. But just something I'd thought about.
Thank
I'm Yvonne, and I've been a Unitarian Universalist for, I don't know, 30 years or something. And I'm a couple of years ago, I heard the story that you presented today, and I was just really perplexed why, I think in the brochure that you refer to, it's not mentioned, I could be wrong on that, but the story about the service committee is the one that's been held up so often.
Well, clearly the service committee story is the most direct, you know, it's the most direct line between the chalice, flaming chalice symbol, becoming a symbol for Unitarian Universalism. The deeper backstory is a much more complicated connection, I guess I'd say. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tom, and this is, I guess, a testimonial. I was in Prague on a business trip a few years ago, and I'll try to keep this short. But I was trying to find the Unitarian Universalist Church that Norbert Chalbrick was involved in. But at that time, there was a property dispute going on, and the Unitarian Universalists were meeting on Sunday afternoons in a place called the Husitska Cerkva, which is the Hussite Church on Svoboda Street. And so I went there instead, and it was a weekday and everything was quiet. But I knocked on the door, and I don't speak Czech, but I speak a little Croatian, and the languages are similar. And the person who answered the door did understand what I was about. And so I was allowed into the church, and I sat for a while. There was a chalice in the front, very similar to the one that we have that we left. And the really amazing thing was that outside the church was a sort of a structure that looked kind of like a steeple with a 25-foot wide chalice on the top of it.
25 foot?
It was huge. It was a landmark that you could see. This was sort of a ridge, and you could see this from across the little part of the metropolitan area. Right? So I'm very grateful to you to hear the story of Janos.
And isn't there I've never been there, but isn't there a large statue of Hus or Hus in one of the main squares?
There's some terracotta relief thing. Oh, in the main square. Oh, there's a king there, not young.
That wouldn't be him.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Okay, but there was some illustrations on the walls of the church and things like that.
Hi, I'm Lynn. Thank you, Drew, for coming and sharing that. And Bill mentioned we had our anniversary and we were downtown Milwaukee, saw the big Potawatomi flaming chalice.
But we got a tenth of the income.
But, you know, when we had the church, maybe you had seen it, we had a cross, you know, when we initially bought the church on the top of our church that we had taken off. And, you know, I thought when I saw that Potawatomi, that would be really cool to have a chalice on it. On the top of our church here. And I'm just wondering, do you know of any church, UU churches that actually do have a chalice on their building?
No. You might be a first. That would be cool. Now, as some of you know, we have a, downtown, we have a rooster on top. And a lot of people, you know, at least periodically, they say, oh, those Unitarians, they couldn't figure out what else to put on top. You know, they didn't want to go with a cross, so they put a rooster up. But in our case, it's actually being faithful to the Gothic architecture of the church, because the church was built to resemble English Gothic architecture. And it was a common in that 1350 to 1550 period of the English Gothic to have a rooster on the top as a weather vane. And so we were just being faithful to the architecture. Other comments? Questions?
My name is Robin, and
where are you? I'm sorry, I can't see you. Oh, there, thank you.
Way back row. When I look at the front of the table up there and see the embroidery,
it always has a special feeling for me because my wife did that about 12 years ago when she died, before she died. And and I have also designed the logo that we use for our letterhead too. So I have special feelings for that symbol. You should.
As far as chalices on churches, we were in Phoenix this last spring. We saw the Phoenix Church, and they have a very dramatic Southwest-style building, which is two stories high, and on the front is a very dramatic flaming chalice on there. In fact, I'll send a photo of it out by email so people can see it. And wouldn't that be nice to put something like that on top of this building?
We'll make this the last one, and then we can carry on the conversation afterwards. So right here.
These ushers get a little workout, don't they?
They do.
Hi, I'm Terry, and so I'm going to make a little jump here, but for those of you who are parents and who are going to go home and talk with your children about the symbol of the chalice and get into the discussion of how important it is to stand up for what you think is right and why we're able to be sitting here and having this kind of discussion and having a Unitarian faith and church and being able to, and it reminds me, I was reading yesterday about this Mr. Sandusky, and we need to speak to our children about sexual abuse and speak to them so that they understand that they can tell us if anybody hurts them or touches them or speaks inappropriately to them, just the way that we have to speak out about any type of freedom as the person who stood up for the freedom that he believed in, or the person in the concentration camp sketched out their vision for freedom every day so that our children can be safe as they walk the streets and as they go to school. It's just so important.
Thank you. That's a perfect way to end this conversation. Thank you for that.
And now is the time for our offertory. Let there be an offering to sustain and strengthen this place, which is sacred to so many of us, a community of memory and of hope, for we are now the keepers of the dream. The offering will now be received. Please rise now as you're willing and able and join in our closing hymn, number 128.
Friends, may life bless us and keep us. May the light of life shine upon us and shine out from within us and be gracious unto us and bring us peace. For this is the day, this is the one wild and precious life we are given. So let us all find a way to rejoice and be glad in it. So may it be.